This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and on the Breakfast Grill this morning is Anton Revutsky, Deputy Chief of Mission, the Embassy of the Russian Federation. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I want to begin our discussion with a look at our respective economies, both of them oil producers and exporters affected by the downturn in the price of crude. There are views about the Russian economy coming from outside, and I want to begin with Barack Obama. Of course, the previous president of the United States said in his final press conference that Russia is a weaker country. It says their economy doesn't produce anything that anybody wants to buy except oil and gas and arms. They don't innovate. Now, a less jaundiced or maybe prejudiced view comes from Kenneth Rogoff, a professor of economics, public policy at Harvard University. He says, without reform, there is little reason to be optimistic about Russia's long-term growth trends, given its poor demographic profile, weak institutions, and abject failure to diversify its economy, despite having an enormously talented and creative population. So I want to begin with those two statements. They're fairly strong statements about the country. What is the Russian view of where the Russian economy is?
Well, first of all, I'd like to comment briefly on what the former president of the United States said about Russian economy. Previously, he mentioned that Russian economy was in tatters. This is, I think, he got it very personal. Of course, I would strongly disagree with that kind of opinion. Our economy is going to grow this year. That would be a modest growth, but the contraction that we experienced in 2015 was also quite modest. So we are getting back to normal. We are adapting to new realities, and that new reality was actually very closely connected to the U.S. and Western sanctions against Russia.
Yeah, I understand that, in fact, and we have some numbers here, that the decline in output in 2015-2016 were comparable to what the United States experienced during its 2008-2009 financial crisis, with a contraction of about 4% of the GDP. Now, all accounts that I've read, Anton, suggest that the shocks from the sanctions plus the plunge in oil prices haven't been as great on the Russian economy. Yet there are problems. In fact, your award-winning Russian central bank governor, she has said, and I quote her, "I think that we need some comprehensive economic policy with coordinated monetary policy, fiscal consolidation policy, and robust agenda of structural reforms. It's true we need to discuss these reforms. The first aim of these reforms, I think, is to improve business confidence, to improve investment climate, to create more incentives for businesses to invest in Russia." She's not the only one, I think, coming up from the Russian side, recognizing the need for reforms that Kenneth Rogoff also spoke of. Tell us where the conversation is in Russia in terms of reform.
Well, my take, my personal take anyway, is that currently we are not talking about the overall reform of Russian economy, something that happened in the 90s when we had to start from the scratch, actually, to build all the institutions from zero ground. But we need to adapt to that new reality. In this context, I would like to mention the legislation, the sanctions that were signed by the new president of the United States in August, the sanctions against Russia, North Korea, and Iran. And it would be virtually impossible to eliminate those sanctions, to wind them down in a short period of time. So that means that within years to come, we would have to operate in a very hostile environment internationally. So the economic reform with import substitution, I know it is very unpopular here in Malaysia, but we would need to address that problem somehow.
Now, putting aside the politics of the sanctions, right, the question of changes that need to happen within the Russian economy. And I'm going to quote here Yevgeny Yasin. He's also a Russian economist. He says that, among other things, there is an inequality of rights among market participants. There are barriers to market entry for new companies. And there's the problem of corruption in Russia. How much is this acknowledged as a problem? And how do you move forward when you have such a situation?
Well, our former Minister of Economic Development is in jail on corruption charges. So that, I think, means that we are very serious about that problem.
So you mean there is political will to go after those who are corrupt, even those
absolutely.
Who are powerful?
Absolutely.
But what about the concentration of power? And this is, of course, a criticism leveled at the President Vladimir Putin, that in fact, one of the problems has been the concentration of power within his hand, within his office.
I think that it is not a problem that is systemic in Russia. And given Russian history, you might acknowledge that concentration of power, given the territory of the country and the size of the population, sometimes is a necessity. So there is always a tricky balance between concentration of power in the hands of the president and the necessity to give the different regions of the country freedom economically. You have to find the right balance under the right economic and political circumstances. So this is a balancing process.
And how is the president persuading the population? I believe, and we see this on television coming from the Western media primarily, of people pushing for democratic reforms in the country. There's a pushback on that, and you know there's a huge conversation around that. Is democracy in the way that the West practices it, kind of liberal democracy, something that Russia cannot afford if only, as you say, to deal with a complex territory, a huge population, and perhaps tendencies to break away? Already in the previous incarnation, the Soviet Union, once it achieved some form of liberalization, did in fact break up, and you are left with the Russian Federation at this point in time. Is democracy, liberal democracy, something that Russia can't afford?
Well, there was an upsurge of liberal protest in 2011, 2012. But since then, people got a little disillusioned about the leaders of that movement. And currently, the level of support for President Putin is very high, very high, and cannot be compared to his colleagues in the West.
Now, I want to come back to the question of the economy. One of the issues that was raised was the ease of business, doing business. And there are some profiles on that. At this point in time, I think for this year, Russia stands ranked 40th in the ease of business rankings. Malaysia is, by comparison, a little better. It's at 23. But Russia used to be at 123 in 2011. So in 6 years, there's been a remarkable improvement in terms of the ease of business. In your experience, do businessmen and women in Malaysia look to Russia for opportunities for business?
I wish they could do more on that account, because sort of coming back to the sanctions issues, this is an opportunity, because these sanctions, the Western sanctions, they created a lot of opportunities for those countries that are not participating, including Malaysia.
But is Russia visible to Malaysian businesses as a destination for investment or to do business?
Well, that's a good question, because we are really too far away from each other. What we need to do is talk more to each other, communicate more to each other, to have a direct flight. An absence of direct flight is a big drawback for developing people-to-people relations. We have a very functional, very good political cooperation. I wish that business people would follow up that. The good news is that I think this month, one of the leading Russian computer security companies, InfoWatch, is opening an office here in Kuala Lumpur. InfoWatch is a computer security company that is run by Natalia Kaspersky.
So if you were to encourage Malaysian businesses to kind of plug into the opportunities you say are now being made available because of the sanctions, paradoxically, what would you encourage them to do? What is it that they should be looking at? What kinds of sectors of the economy? Even Kenneth Rogoff said that, you know, the Russians are extraordinarily talented people. Where is it they would go?
I think there's a range of opportunities to develop business in Russia at the moment. Well, that depends on the profile and the qualifications of Malaysian companies. I think there is a lot of business experience that Russia could borrow from Malaysia. If you ask me, I would recommend looking more into opportunities to have some cooperation in city transportation, for example. But what I see here in Kuala Lumpur is amazing. We have subway. We have had it for like 80 years. But the scale and the operation of public transportation in Kuala Lumpur is very impressive.
I'm speaking to Anton Revitsky, Deputy Chief of Mission, Embassy of the Russian Federation. Next up, we look at Russia and its influence in the world. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning. If you just joined us, I'm Sharad Kutin, and our guest this morning is Anton Revitsky, Deputy Chief of Mission, the Embassy of the Russian Federation. I want to begin, Anton. In 2013, President Vladimir Putin introduced a new concept for Russia's foreign policy that said it would rely more on soft power and expressed confidence that the country's influence in the world would continue to strengthen. Now, this is 2013, and a lot has happened since 2013. Of course, in 2013, the price of crude was very high. I think it was around $100 per barrel. Now it's much lower. But it also in the intervening years we've had, and I can't go through the list of events that of significance, including the annexation of Crimea. But maybe more importantly for a Malaysian audience, the question of MH17. Is that a problem for bilateral relations between Russia and Malaysia?
Well, first of all, you mentioned the annexation, the so-called annexation of Crimea, and understandably, I must say something about that. That was not an annexation. That was something done in total accordance with international law when people expressed their will overwhelmingly during the referendum. By the way, some people mentioned that Kosovo example. That was not a popular vote. Only the parliament voted to have a separate state, whereas in Crimea there was expression of popular will. This is to say nothing about the history of the issue and how the Crimea became
part
of the Ukrainian Socialist Republic.
Okay.
As to MH17, I could quote a couple of sentences from what my president said on the issue. It was an interview with Oliver Stone. He said that, first of all, we should all understand that was a huge tragedy, the massive loss of human life. And we mourn together with the relatives of the victims, no matter what country they come from. Then he dwelled on the investigation that was done by the joint investigation team. And we do have some issues about that. And
mean in terms of the findings of the investigation team?
Yes. We believe that the investigation should have been done in a different way. We think that the evidence should have been collected more thoroughly, and all the possibilities should have been examined more profoundly. And of course, given the history, and what I mean by the history is that Russian plane that was shot down by the Ukrainians in 2001, I think that given that episode, the Ukrainian side should be among the suspects. It's not as part of the investigation.
So does it remain a sticking point for relations between Malaysia and the Russian Federation?
I think this is a question for Malaysian side, first of all, not to Russian. It is being discussed. at every major meeting between our politicians. And, well, the Malaysian side raises its concerns, and we give them our understanding of the situation.
Now, coming back to President Putin's 2013 push for soft power and in his new relationship to the world, there was a recent study by Pew Global, and it says that Russia's international image is generally more negative than it is positive, but critical opinions of Russia do not amount to people feeling that Russia is a threat. It says that there are only three countries surveyed where there are, in fact, a majority favorable opinion of Russia. That's in, interestingly enough, two of those countries are in Southeast Asia, Vietnam and the Philippines. The other country is Greece. What do you make of Russia's image in the world? And do you think this Pew survey accords with your understanding of the Russian image globally?
Well, I don't think I would agree with that assessment. I worked in China for 13 years. I think the image of Russia in China is very good. President Putin is very popular in China.
And is it because there's a tendency among people in China and Russia who are used to strong leaders? They see strong leaders. In fact, this is often said of Donald Trump, the president of the United States, that he too likes strong leaders, and therefore, at least in the early months of his administration, seemed very positive in wanting to change the relationship between the U.S. and Russia. He saw something of himself in other strong leaders. Is there a cultural tendency, do you think, to view strong leaders as a good thing?
No, I think that's because the people in China or in Vietnam get information not from the English language papers, but from Chinese and Vietnamese. I don't know what happened to mass media in the West, but every article I read about Russia has some negative background inside. That reminds me of the propaganda campaign that was waged against Serbia in the 90s, when every time you read a report about what was going on in former Yugoslavia, you would see a comparison of Serbs and Nazis. So this is very irrational approach, and of course it does influence the public opinion in the Western Hemisphere. But that's, once again, the West doesn't represent the whole world.
To what extent has Russia tried to correct this image? Soft power often comes in the form of popular culture, movies, people-to-people exchanges. Has Russia done enough to correct the image that you see is incorrectly portrayed in the Western media?
I think we are doing a lot in that direction. Russia Today, which is the name of the TV channel, it is very popular around the world. It got huge investment from the government, and you could see celebrities like Larry King or other well-known TV anchors working for Russia Today.
I want to move on to the question of specific diplomatic initiatives that they've had globally. The North Korean crisis is a particular one close to home, as it were. There are analyses that say that Russia and China are together in terms of their understanding of the North Korean situation, that what they both countries want is stability in Pyongyang. They don't want regime change. They want no drastic alteration to the geopolitical dynamic in that region, and they certainly want to avoid a massive refugee crisis that would result from any kind of military intervention. Could you give us a sense of how Russia sees the problem of North Korea, those missile launches that they've had? What do you think is the Russian solution to the problem?
I'd like to stress that Russia doesn't support the nuclear status for the DPRK. And we also don't support the North Koreans launching ballistic missiles in violation of the relevant UN security resolutions. At the same time, we understand why they do it.
And why do they do it?
Because they feel very insecure. Because unlike the picture in the Western media, the North Korean military cannot be compared to South Korean military or Japanese military, to say nothing about the U.S. military.
They're much weaker, you say.
Much weaker. And they get constant threats. South Korean soldiers using the photos of North Korean leaders to train. There's a merry-go-round with the military games in the area. And they train on a routine basis. They train taking out the North Korean leadership, the so-called decapitating operations. So what kind of response do you expect from North Korea?
Recently, South Korean initiative proposed to Moscow, in fact, is to build, and I'm going to quote here, 9 bridges of cooperation. And this has to do with engaging North Korea in terms of gas, railways, northern sea route, shipbuilding, agriculture, and other forms of cooperation. These have been tried before. Is this the way Russia also thinks that the way forward in terms of dialing down on the tensions in the Korean Peninsula or moving forward in terms of getting North Korea to give up its nuclear ambitions?
I'm afraid that in terms of nuclear ambitions, we've passed the no return point. I was actually in China when the six-party negotiations were going on. I was in that room. I was part of our delegation, and I can tell you that for some time the negotiation was quite successful, and that resulted in September 2005 statement, essentially saying that North Korea is willing to give up its nuclear program in exchange for 2 light water reactors. If the other party, I'm not saying other parties, because there was actually one other party of negotiation important for the outcome. If that other party, you know, remained true to its obligations, to its words, then the situation could be quite different.
Which is that other party?
Oh, you know that other party.
Okay.
And I would like also to quote former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who quite recently said that what they want is a firm treaty guaranteeing North Korea that the U.S. will not attack them or hurt them in any way unless they attack one of their neighbors, Carter said. But the United States has refused to do that.
Let's move away from North Korea to look at the South China Sea, because your experience in China might help us understand what's going on. From the Russian perspective of what seems to be a kind of standoff between America that used to provide the security architecture for Southeast Asia predominantly, and now China coming in with its ambitions with this 9-dash line, as well as China's growing diplomatic initiatives in the region, you know, the One Belt, One Road initiative, its huge investments in the region. Does Russia see an increasing imbalance of power in the region? Do they see a potential for instability in the ASEAN region?
Well, we do. And that's why one of Russia's initiatives for the region is the new architecture for security here.
Could you give us an outline, a sense of what this new architecture might be?
At this point, we suggest that the countries involved should start a discussion on what it is supposed to look like. And then we could discuss what kind of an end game we see as a result of that discussions.
Where would Russia be in this architecture?
Russia would be a member of the East Asian summits and ARF. So if the countries involved, they manage to find a solution to their problems, then it could be institutionalized, like something that we had in Europe in 1975, in the so-called Helsinki Act, that set the guidelines for security architecture in Europe.
Does Russia see the potential for conflict in the region anytime soon?
Well, I think the situation in Southeast Asia is anyway much better than the situation in Northeast Asia and in the Middle East and in many places in the world. But the very fact that there are a number of countries that have territorial issues in the region, that, of course, sets potential for future conflicts.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Anton Revutsky, a deputy chief of mission, Embassy of the Russian Federation. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Sharad Kutin, BFM 89.9, The
that
Business.
This episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U Mobile, where data hearts you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.